Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan.
And I am Blue.
And we're here to talk about game design. This month, we're looking at crossovers. Although, we're not just looking at things in the Smash Brothers sense of shoving a bunch of characters together in one game. We're really more trying to focus on games that integrate the mechanical sides of each game into one cohesive experience.
Having said that, we did talk about Smash as a possibility for this game for a while. It's not like it's not there.
Yeah, it's not like it's not there, and like one of the games is more sort of let's bring in a bunch of stuff, but I think here what we're looking at is like a more holistic approach to crossovers and integration.
And also a lot of you dear listeners probably know the Smash Brothers example. It's really cool. Everyone is here, right?
Yeah, and how do you represent a lot of characters in the same system is really complicated and interesting as a design problem. But it's a very different design problem, I think, than integrating the systems of two different franchises together.
So yeah, that's basically it. And really, really good just mesh of one system interacting with the weaknesses of another system and holding it up would be our first game.
Professor Layton vs. Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney, is a 2012 puzzle adventure game developed by Capcom and Level 5, directed by Shu Takami and Atsushi Kano, and produced by Hironobu Takeshita and Takayuki Hama, and designed by Shu Takami. This game obviously combines Layton and Wright together. So these are both adventure games, each with a different focus to them. So the Layton franchise is very much structured around going to places, talking to people, and solving puzzles.
They're not quite WarioWare quick-fire puzzles, but they are short and contained puzzles, something you're supposed to be able to solve in a couple of minutes.
And they're often very mechanically distinct. I don't think they're short, though. Some of them can be quite difficult and take a while. But they do have that WarioWare-esque, like, every puzzle is quite distinctly different mechanically, and that creates, like, a lot of variety in the things. The Phoenix Wright games are more famous, perhaps, for their courtroom scenes. So they have investigation scenes where you talk to people and gather information, but you sort of bring all that together into the courtroom to solve the mysteries. But the investigation sequences of Phoenix Wright have always felt a bit lacking, I think, to many players. They're not terribly engaging and more about just triggering a bunch of flags to ensure you can progress. What Layton versus Wright does is it brings Layton into the investigation phase primarily. And by sort of enriching that investigation phase, bringing more gameplay into it, I think really elevates the whole experience. What's more interesting, though, is aside from this, like, structural thing that's very obvious to pinpoint, Layton's impact on the writing and the structure of the mysteries themselves is really compelling, I think, too. So one of the interesting things here is that in the Phoenix Wright games, often the courtroom cases require you to make a lot of dramatic leaps in logic and a lot of sort of leaps of faith into weird places, which you still do here. But the way that Layton gets brought in here is that in this game, you're basically doing witch trials. So you have to deal with magic in the context of the courtroom. But the magic here has a lot of very distinct set rules. And so a lot of the court case is kind of puzzling out in a much more Layton-esque way how these spells and magic were used in the game. And this lends a very different feeling to Phoenix's court cases, even if mechanically those sections are still mostly the same as the Phoenix Wright games.
Yeah, it is very distinct. Even in the beginning, you have a very long stretch with Layton. I wouldn't blame anyone if you didn't know the title of the game and you just jumped in at that point to think that, oh, this is just another Layton game. And it doesn't blend together until the characters really come together, right?
And it takes a long time until you get to the first court case, I feel, after the very, very introductory one. And so it can really feel like, oh, this is going to be mostly a Layton experience with a bit of Wright. And in some senses, it is. This has always been a thing in the Wright games as well, just that the courtroom sections are a shorter proportion of the game, but where a lot of the drama lies.
I think, to be completely honest, the designers outdid themselves, because this game has a fantastic feeling. And it really stems from how mechanically diverse the two series are and how much the game leans into both of them. Like, when we're in a Leighton investigation slash story sequence, we are fully in Leighton's, I guess we're not in Leighton's point of view, because that's part of the mystery of like, oh, what does Leighton actually think about all of this? But we're in that corner of the ring. Right.
Yeah, we're in that mode of like mystery and whimsy and so on that Leighton sort of specializes in.
Where it's just bombast.
Yeah, it's very bombastic. It's very silly and upfront with its silliness. Not that Leighton is serious, but it's a very different kind of non-seriousness to it.
Leighton's the straight man to his weird world.
Yes.
And Wright is just this screaming hobo in the courtroom sometimes, it feels like.
Yeah, very much so. On that tonal thing, so in an adventure game, level design can be expressed through writing style. It's like if the goal of the game is to obtain information, reason out that information, and use it to solve problems, then how a game is written will impact that. And Phoenix Wright and Leighton together, or Phoenix Wright and Leighton, actually, they have very different writing styles. Leighton is full of a lot more whimsy. It's very much based on sort of European and like sort of faux British aesthetics. And it's going for a very different tone of silliness to Wright's, which is going for a much more quote unquote anime sort of vibe to it. And so by having these different writing styles in interacting with each other, you get a very different feel and like way that you get information. Much like the way that magic in this world works comes into the court battles and changes how you approach that side of the game. In that sense, the fact you're doing investigations for witch trials changes the context in which you are seeking out information as Leighton. There's a bit more urgency in what you're doing in those investigation scenes than what Leighton games usually carry. For a lot of them.
Mm.
Not that they lack climax, like Leighton games eventually like ramp up and get you a dramatic climax that you are in theory supposed to feel time pressure for, but it's much different in this game. It's much more direct for the whole experience.
That it? Because that really covers...
Yeah.
So I think that really covers all of the huge key points these two series have.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is a really good foundation to come into for the rest of the games that we're talking about. And with that, let's talk about the next one. Cadence of Hyrule, Crypt of the Necrodancer, featuring The Legend of Zelda, is the very long title of the 2019 rhythm action roguelike adventure with meta progression elements developed by Brace Yourself Games, directed by Ryan Clark and Toshihisa Nakaido, produced by Makoto Isobe, and designed by Oliver Trujillo and Ryan Clark. I'm sorry if some of the names aren't quite right there. So this is obviously a combination of Legend of Zelda and Crypt of the Necrodancer, if you didn't catch that in the title, which isn't very clear about this, I think.
Yeah, look, you could be forgiven because I'm not sure when to pay attention when that title's being read out.
There's a lot of that official title, and I bought the game in Japan, so in katakana, the script which you write foreign characters in, foreign things in, it's even longer, like, because it just takes up so much more space in Japanese, and that's usually not the case for localized titles. Anyway, so this takes elements of Zelda and Crypt of the Necrodancer. So Zelda is a planned content game that you generally traverse a world solving puzzles, and generally with significant key points being represented by dungeons that each contain a key item that generally gives you a new verb. A lot of Zelda games have slightly different structures, but generally this key items that get you verbs that are got through dungeons is the broad core thing. It's not an RPG with direct level ups per se, but over the course of the game, you generally obtain more powerful things and more vitality through heart containers.
Before we move on to Necrodancer, Zelda as a series can roughly be broken down. There's a lot of ways to break it down, but there's one of the big splits was 2D versus 3D, and there's a certain feel that the 2D top-down Zeldas get, which is a lot of the feel that this crossover game.
That's a very fair point. And yeah, Necrodancer is a rhythm action roguelike. So it takes on a lot of the aspects of more traditional roguelikes in that it's tile-based movement, enemies move as you do in general, but it matches that to having to move on the beat. It adds that rhythmic element to the game, which you can actually turn off in this if you really want to. But there's that aspect that's forcing you to make decisions quickly, that forces you to often make suboptimal decisions because you're having to do it on the beat as opposed to at your own pace. And this game brings them together. In many ways, it's more of a Necrodancer game in like the moment to moment, in that you're moving on the beat, You're moving around the world in this tile-based format. But unlike Necrodancer, which generates the dungeon every time you boot up the game, in this, when you make your save file, it generates the world at once. And that world will be the same for the entirety of your playthrough until you finish the quest line, beat the final boss, and do all that good stuff.
So you could just roll New World until you find something you like in the early bits you want it to by just making save files.
Yeah, there's an option in the game as well to turn on permadeath so that when you die, it does just wipe the world at the same time as well. So you can play it more traditionally, but that's definitely an option you can turn on rather than being the default.
Yeah, it's a challenge setting in this case.
Yeah.
Not intended gameplay.
So Necrodancer is very difficult, I think, as a game experience. And it's really interesting conceptually, but I feel like for me, one of the big things about this mix is that Zelda brings in a lot of visual language that I already know that helps me read the experience. Like, I have an idea of what all these monsters do when I see them, and Necromancer, like, taps into a lot of convention to help you know, like, oh, that's a big dragon. It probably deals damage and breathes fire at a distance. It's a good guess about how something might work in Necrodancer. But that mechanical language of Zelda is a bit clearer to me, at least, than the Necrodancer language was.
Yeah, Swarm you, Octoroks shoot at you.
And what Zelda adds to this formula is the collection of tools, the collection of new verbs. And this is partially because Zelda doesn't commit to Necrodancer's playable on a dance mat aesthetic that it was going for.
Yeah.
So you only use the D-pad and a confirm button, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But Zelda uses the D-pad and the full collection of controller buttons, each mapped to a different item as you collect them, that you can remap as you collect more than the buttons allow. So you can get, like, bows, hookshots, bombs, and various classical Zelda items that each allow you to do different things and solve different puzzles in the overworld and traverse the different sections. So you have that basic Necrodancer core being overlaid with the Legend of Zelda structure and progression that does a lot to ease the game, because Crypt is hard, but Zelda, through earning things, is sort of easier, and the fact you can learn areas by repeating content much more so than Necrodancer helps you get used to things. So I think after I finished this, I felt much better about going to Necrodancer, even if I still don't quite jive with that experience fundamentally. So Zelda is always, like, defined, I think, a lot by its puzzles. Or puzzles is a strong word maybe for a lot of them, but it's defined by this more, like, structured approach to how to deal with problems. And that really influences a lot of even the combat experiences that I think have environmental things like pushing boulders, setting up Octoroks to be killed in time and things, that lends it just a bit more puzzliness than I feel like was present in Necrodancer, which is maybe a bit more frantic.
Yeah, because, like, in a Zelda dungeon, you do not expect to just fight enemies, right?
Yeah.
Honestly, it feels like your opponent is the dungeon, because rooms will be locked, enemies will be spawned in at the most inopportune times, the lights will go out every now and then, you'll have to dodge boulders and pitfalls. Like, an acceptable enemy in a Zelda dungeon doesn't even do damage to you sometimes, it just knocks you around, because that can knock you into hazards or off of ledges. And that's not really in Necrodancer, that's not really a thing. That's all your enemies, all your problems can be beaten by smacking in the head, unless it can't be killed, right? So,
and in this, most enemies are killable. Like, it's still very Necrodancer in that sense, but that philosophy of having many ways to deal with a problem is very present. Oh, this enemy has a shield. Maybe I can hookshot it away. Oh, I can stun this while I'm dealing with other things with the hookshot and things like that.
I think the core here is there's a lot more verbs in the moment-to-moment Necrodancer sections.
Yes, than Necrodancer would usually have. And then an interesting point that you brought up before recording is bosses. Bosses are a really interesting harmony between these two franchises. Do you want to elaborate a bit more on that?
Absolutely. So the bosses in Legend of Zelda, traditionally, if we're talking about puzzles, the bosses are almost the closest you'll get to, like, this is just a puzzle piece, right? Bosses have distinct weaknesses. There is an obvious, hopefully, way to tackle it. Did you get a hookshot in this dungeon? Chances are hookshot's going to be useful for this boss. Did you get bow and arrow in this dungeon? Might be a giant eye for you to shoot a few times. And to kind of, like, reinforce that, bosses in Legend of Zelda, in my experience, tend to be large and in the center of your focus in the boss room. They dominate your attention in a boss room for Legend of Zelda, because they become something you have to dodge and that you have to react. gives this really epic end of dungeon feel. Crypt of the Necrodancer, however, has a much more give and take approach to the boss, as in there's a lot more movement. There's a lot of working around the boss, but not in the sense of I'm trying to, you know, shoot your weakness. It's more of like the boss is going to try and take up space, and in terms of its hitbox and its attacks, and you have to dodge it and then still strike the boss. So it's a dance, right? It's a rhythm game dance, the Crypt of the Necrodancer boss. And in the cadence union between the two ideas, bosses still have gimmicks. They still, you know, the really cool thing is that there are Zelda bosses combined with a musical instrument, like Go Maracas and Wizrobo. And that extends to how they attack as well. Like the Go Maracas does take up space with some of its attacks, like launching like goo onto the stage that you then have to deal with while moving. But you have this kind of extra puzzle element on top of trying to dance around the boss, Crypt of the Necrodancer style. You also have to deal with the boss like putting out gimmick traps, taking up space into the level. And the bosses are scaled down, I think, in size. They don't take up quite as much of the room space, from my recollection at least. And yeah, you have these like super themed bosses that are very Zelda looking. They have Zelda gimmick style attacks, but you have to dance around them. Crypt of the Necrodancer.
Yeah, evading the boss is a much larger component, I think, of the battles than it is traditionally in a Zelda game. And because of the way that Necrodancer works, like if you want to use the bow and arrow against something, you have to position to be facing up at the correct time to fire the arrow up. You can't just turn on the spot like you would in a Zelda game and things. So it really creates a strong spatial puzzling element that feels very Zelda-y, but is not something that you usually get in traditional Zelda. Well, with that then, let's look at the next game. Etrian Mystery Dungeon is a 2015 roguelike with long-form progression developed by Spike Chunsoft and Atlus, directed by Yukari Yokoro, Seiichiro Nagahata, and produced by Shigeo Komori. So this is a combination of the Etrian Odyssey franchise and the Mystery Dungeon franchise. Now, Mystery Dungeon is a series somewhat famous for its crossovers. The series, in fact, starts as a crossover with Dragon Quest, with Torneko's Mystery Dungeon. Its own identity is with Shirin Mystery Dungeon. And then there are lots of spin-offs that are Chocobo's Mystery Dungeon, Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, and things like that. Extensive series.
It's a formula that can lend itself to a lot of different aesthetics and themings. That's not necessarily the case with Etrian. Etrian isn't really a theming. So
Mystery Dungeon is generally focused on sort of tile-based, turn-by-turn movement, and collecting a lot of items and using them effectively and carefully. Generally with pretty severe penalties for dying in the dungeon, usually losing everything. Although in a lot of the spin-offs, like Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, they tend to remove a lot of the penalty from them. Etrian is a first-person dungeon crawler in the vein of Wizardry and various other like late 80s, early 90s PC RPGs. And it's really designed around having these very well-designed dungeons in which you must meticulously map them on the DS's lower screen. So Etrian is very much about understanding one coherent, strongly designed space with a strong sense of place to it, and getting deeper and deeper every time, getting stronger as you play through. A big feature of the games that separates them from other first-person dungeon crawlers are FOEs, which have various names in the games.
Yeah, they get backronymed in a lot of different ways.
The Japanese acronym, which is most descriptive of what they are, is Field On Enemies, which should be On Field Enemies. But they want it to sound like foe, as an opponent, so.
Yes.
Anyway, so these are enemies on the field, represented usually by large glowing spheres to make the game easy to make. And these are usually very powerful foes that whenever you move one space on the board, so do they. So there's a little bit of that roguelike DNA there in the I move one step, they move one step kind of thing. But generally, they encourage that really intense understanding of the level design because they're usually powerful enough that you either can't beat them or you will burn all your resources defeating them. So you have to navigate the dungeon to avoid them carefully to get to a room that you're safe from them in. So these games have this really strong tension between procedural content and planned content. Since one of these games is all about dungeon diving in a planned content understanding a limited space sense, and the other is about adapting to procedural content developed on the fly. And this tension is, I think, really interesting. Ultimately, this game is more Mystery Dungeon than Etrian, but the way these things interact is kind of cool. So in this game, you have the ability to plant forts in the game. A fort will lock down the structure of a dungeon. So each floor of a dungeon is procedurally generated, but the way that the floors interact is not. What I mean by that is you can basically take multiple different stairways down. So a dungeon has more than just floor one, floor two, floor three. It's like you have floor one, and then the second floor might be, there might be a left second floor and a right second floor. So you have like a tree branching diagram almost.
Mm-hmm.
And where there are dead ends, where you can go back up, where you can get back onto the other path, that can vary every run unless you plant a fort.
Yep.
Why would you plant a fort though? Why not just adapt the sequence? Well, knowing the layout of the dungeon lets you get to the bottom quicker, and getting to the bottom quicker lets you fight the boss of each dungeon having taken less damage, which is a very Etrian thing. If you want to get to the boss, you don't want to take much damage beforehand.
Can you imagine if every time you tried to do a boss run in Dark Souls, the layout changed? How much harder that game would become?
So you have that on your side. There are also DOEs, which have a fancy Latin backronym, I think. But in the same way that FOEs are field on enemies, these are dungeon enemies, basically. And sometimes they can attack your forts and break them.
Well, okay. So the tension that we should talk about here is, in Etrian Odyssey, the FOEs are designed to make you respect a dungeon space and not be able to just rush through it. It effectively makes the space less linear because you have to work around the FOEs. In Etrian Mystery Dungeon, where the, you know, layouts of every dungeon floor are randomized, you can't have this deliberate FOE that's just making your life miserable anymore. So the threat of a DOE is different. It's not that it's making your traversal of the dungeon harder. It has to threaten something else because they can't plan the FOE threat. And what a DOE does is it threatens your hub town.
Yes, that is the other thing. So not only does it get your forts are there to prevent DOEs attacking the town. And the town is like a big part of your meta structure. It's how you get new items. It's how you get rewards. It's how you get quests that help you level up faster.
It's not quite like in the modern roguelite where your town levels up and you get stronger, but a lot of your strength and recovery of strength is tied to this town.
And you can repair things once they get broken, but it's resources that you want to be putting to other things.
And it should be noted that it also costs resources to repair a fort, but less so than repairing a town. And it also makes it easier for you to get the resources to repair the town. The fort, sorry. If it's just a fort that goes down.
Forts also tie into another aspect of Etrian, which is parties. Etrian Odyssey usually has parties of five characters. Etrian Mystery Dungeon only has four characters in a party, and excess characters can be placed in forts. And while characters are in forts, they also level up. So the forts are a way in which you can be leveling up alternative characters in different classes to your core party. They function well there.
The strength of your characters matters as well. Right?
That's right. So unlike most games like this, when you die, you keep all your levels. You lose one item in each character's inventory. So, you know, you might lose your weapon, your armor, your boots, but you only lose one of those things, but you keep your level. And that's really important because Etrian Odyssey games are often about building characters over time, creating builds, and you have a lot of the classic Etrian skill trees here. So you're building builds much like you would in Etrian, working together as a team in combat, which is done in this sort of standard roguelike, everyone's on the field together, and your party members are usually controlled by AI, and you can be controlling one of them at a time for combats. And in bosses, you control each of them turn by turn because the game really wants you to focus in on the precision of the boss. And I guess it doesn't want you to feel annoyed that your teammates ruin things when things got difficult, even if it makes them take a bit longer. Anyway, so we have this extra thing here that Mystery Dungeon games usually don't take part in, which is long-term character growth for your characters. But that is how Etrian is like brought in here. It's one of the key ways that that happens.
Yeah, I mean, Etrian is a standard, I think, 50-hour plus RPG, and a lot of that's grinding.
Yeah, that's probably a little long, but yes, they're not short.
I think I was talking about 50 hours as post-game content. But yeah, 40 to 50-hour game, and a lot of that's grinding. Well, maybe not grinding, but like, a lot of that's fighting. A lot of that is in dungeons, like progressing through a dungeon, which...
inching your dungeons one extra little bit further.
Yeah, it is very meticulous and slow, but almost meditative, because the random encounters in Etrian aren't particularly hard, but they do cost you resources, which, like, when you just get that chipped away at, it hurts by the time you hit the end of the dungeon. And Mystery Dungeon is just not.
The combat in Etrian is about testing your build and how well you've thought out what you're going to do.
Yeah, because you can have explosive power, but how much can you sustain that?
And here it's sort of a bit similar, actually. Like, in general, the enemies in these dungeons are pretty easy, but they will eat away at your HP. And this game introduces a hunger-style mechanic as well, which forces you to change up which characters in the lead, as it's their hunger that gets consumed when you move around the dungeon. It also makes thinking about space really important, because in Etrian Mystery Dungeon, you can regain your skill points very easily, your TP, but it requires you standing on certain tiles to do so. And whichever character's in first will be the character that steps on those tiles. So it really requires you to think a lot about the order in which your party members are running around in and their relationship to space. So much like the FOEs force players to think about space in Etrian Odyssey, the way that you regain your hunger meter and the way that you gain back TP, let's use the same word each time, does make you pay a bit more attention to the space as well.
So if we were to like compare it back to the previous two games that we've spoken about, specifically to Cadence of Hyrule, where Cadence is a lot of supplementing or like swapping out aspects of one game and interposing it into another. Etrian Mystery Dungeon really feels like if we wanted to do a Mystery Dungeon but with Etrian trappings, what happens? Oh, well, the game needs to now go a lot longer, because that's a big core of how Etrian is. And the reason it has to go longer is because Etrian really cares about chipping away resources and proving that you can manage over a long period of time. Well, what does that mean to the Mystery Dungeon formula now? What can we bring in from there? Well, there's, hunger and like the typical roguelike trappings. Yes, it is still just like mashing these two genres together, but because they're so disparate in their dungeon diving philosophy, you get something that's very distinct from either game in its dungeon dive.
And yeah, this is a really interesting combination in that they are both dungeon crawlers. Like, many people would describe them as, that's a dungeon crawler. They're just incredibly different sides of the spectrum in what the dungeons are like.
So with Layton and Wright, it is a Layton exploration game with Phoenix Wright court scenes. With Cadence of Hyrule, it is a Zelda game, but every time you go into a dungeon, you have to play Crypt of the Necrodancer.
Cadence of Hyrule is always a Necrodancer game, even outside the dungeons.
Even when you move around outside. But, the world is a Zelda world, and you're playing it as if it's a Necrodancer game. In my opinion, with Etrian Mystery Dungeon, it really feels like Etrian Mystery Dungeon. Yes, there's trappings of Etrian Odyssey and there's trappings of all the Mystery Dungeon stuff, but this formula is the result is this unique blend between the two that's not...
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's just a Mystery Dungeon game with Etrian theming and structure. It feels very distinct and different, with how you manage resources quite differently to traditional Mystery Dungeon games. I manage the long form aspects very differently to classic Mystery Dungeon. And with that, I think let's look at our next game.
This is the tournament for the new millennium. You'll experience the most exciting battle in history. Let's get ready to battle. Feel the intensity when power and technique collide.
So, unlike the previous three titles, where it's very clearly Game A meets Game B and what happens, we are going to talk about one where it's Company A meets Company B. Capcom versus SNK2, Mark of the Millennium, 2001, is a 2001 2D crossover fighting game produced by Capcom. Not to be confused with SNK versus Capcom SDC Chaos, which is produced by SNK, which worked on it at about the same time. They've done this kind of thing before where, you know, Company A and Company B both work on a crossover game and let's see what happens between them.
Capcom versus SNK was the start of the same different companies. We had Street Fighter versus X-Men, Marvel versus Capcom by this point, but we hadn't had
Fighting Game Company versus Fighting Game Company. So this is pretty historic, but if you know, this is Capcom versus SNK 2. And this game is directed and designed by Hideaki Itsuda. So we have traditionally done badly when talking about fighting games. Today we are making a concentrated effort to be better about it. Let's start with how this game plays. This is a fighting game wherein two players, possibly a computer, each control one character on screen, and your goal is to deplete the life bar of your opponent by attacking. That's the basics, and that's the gist of it.
Correct.
Now, what is interesting here is this game didn't just blend in here's our fighters versus your fighters in our engine. This game was ambitious? Question mark.
I think ambitious is the right word.
I think they got there is the thing, right? Like, on once you see the result, it looks like it makes sense. And I'm beating around the bush here. But what they did is they included what the game calls six grooves. And choosing a groove is the first thing you do, and then you choose your characters. I think that's right.
Yes, you choose your groove. All the characters you pick must be of the same groove, or are set to the same groove, I should say.
Yeah, set to the groove that you pick. And what then happens is each character plays with that set, and the grooves are split into three Capcom grooves and three SNK grooves. And in fact, the naming of them are
CAP and SNK.
Yeah, like I didn't know how to like be smart about it. They literally just named them after their companies. So you have the C groove, A groove, P groove, S groove, and groove, K groove.
And these define the universal mechanics that all the characters in your team will have access to. So things like guards, runs, dashes, and so on.
These are really cool separation of the company's philosophies. Why, you might ask, are there three grooves per company if there's only two companies? Well, these two companies have made more than one fighting game, and even within a company, you can have different styles to a fighting game. To simplify a lot of our conversation here, we are going to try to talk about primarily just two grooves, just to keep it simple. And I think that two grooves that really exemplify the differences would be the P groove and the S groove, because both of these provide new verbs when you select them. So from the top again, fighting game, simple fighting game, one character on each side, attack until the other person doesn't have health. To make it more complicated, you can choose which type of fighting game you're playing effectively, which groove you are selecting changes the sum of the verbs that you have. A lot of the verbs are normal. You can punch, you can kick. But for example, if you pick the P groove, you can also parry. And parry is when the opponent attacks. If you time a forward motion at just the right time, you will not take damage and be in an advantageous position. A new thing. No other groove can do this.
And this is something that is supposed to represent Street Fighter 3, is kind of the idea behind it.
Contrast, S-groove. S-groove cannot parry, so if you tap forward when the opponent's about to hit you, you block it with your face, which is to say you got hit. However, it introduces a new subsystem wherein when your health is low, you can spam super moves as much as you want. This is not overpowered because super moves tend to have recovery frames wherein you're vulnerable after doing them. So if you do it at the wrong time, you will take a lot of damage. However, it's a comeback mechanic, and the P groove cannot do this.
It only has level 1 supers until this moment, so you're sort of sacrificing high damage output earlier on in the match as well for this unlimited supers.
Yeah, and this is really watering it down, because we can really get lost in the weeds here. There's a lot of differences between each of these grooves, but the important thing is to understand that they're bringing different philosophies to the table here and allowing you to play around with that. So, oh, cool, that makes sense. I can play as if I'm playing Street Fighter 3, or I can play as if S-Groove is loosely based on the King of Fighters 98. That makes sense. But what is cool here about this game, what this game really wanted to like explore, is what if you played Ryu, a Capcom character, the fighting game character, right? White gi, red headband. What if you played him like a King of Fighters 98 character? What if he could spam unlimited level 1 supers? What if he could just do his big fireball super end on end on end, right? What if you take Iori Yagami, like pretty boy angsty teen of the King of Fighters series, and played him like a Street Fighter 3 character with parry? What does that feel like? And that's what this allows. You can take your beloved SNK characters and play them like Capcom characters. You can take your beloved Capcom characters and play them like SNK characters. And so the mechanics of this goes beyond just, we put these characters on the same screen in the same fighting game, and it's, what if I played Terry Bogard with Capcom mechanics? Yeah, as a Street Fighter character. To non-fighting game players, that may not mean much, but they're not compatible systems.
And it's a real big difference to the more classical idea of the crossover fighter like Smash Brothers, where you force everyone into one system. Sure, in Smash Brothers, Terry Bogard can do special moves like he can in King of Fighters, but he's not playing in the King of Fighters system at all. And this is more saying these characters are one component of the crossover, and these systems are another part of the crossover. And it's that mixing and matching of characters and systems that creates, I think, a lot of the joy of this crossover. What does A look like as B?
And there's a lot more to unpack here, which we don't want to get into too much because it's not the point. We're not here to just talk about Capcom's SNK, which we would end up doing if we went into full detail. Please, I encourage you to look up the differences. There's actually a great table that lists some of these differences out. But let's talk very quickly about like the feel of even just the Capcom grooves have dash and the SNK grooves have run. Even that is such a minor thing, but changes the feel of a character immensely.
And when we say the words dash and run, I'm sure someone is listening thinking, those are synonyms. So in fighting game terms, a dash is like a set distance you move when you double tap forwards or backwards.
It's kind of like a small burst of movement laterally.
Whereas a run is maintained. You can run as long as you hold forwards. Dashes, you have to dash every time you want to move that set distance quickly. And that really changes the feeling of aggression and how distance matters and what moves are useful at getting out of different situations and things.
And I suppose, interestingly, as a like small side effect of this, this isn't just a slap paste in mechanics characters and it all just works. This is sprite-based. A lot of the Capcom characters wouldn't even have run animations before this game.
No.
Before the series,
I would say. When I was playing this for review, I played as Sakura from Street Fighter Alpha. By the time this was out, her sprite was probably 5 years old. So they had to maintain the style of a five-year-old sprite and make new running animations for her to fit in with it, because this game uses sprites from a lot of different eras of game, and so you have to maintain each sprite's coherency with itself. Each new sprite you added, which is a lot of work for a game that can look maybe in hindsight a bit cheap with how much it's merging different eras together. A lot of work was really put in to make all of this fit together.
All of the SNK characters needed to have a parry animation added into the game for the flip side example, because in theory, any character in this game can parry, and that's a unique animation. So really, really cool. And if you're interested in like digging into it, this is one of the beloved games. For good reason. The amount of expression, like player expression via mechanics in this game is really astounding. Do look into it if this sounds interesting. And I think we're going to wrap up here before we get stuck into the details.
With a game that I think our audience should be very familiar with by now.
So, for the final game, I know up top we said we weren't going to do a Smash Brothers style, here's just a bunch of games in one, but with this one, it will be a bit of just listing how it's done some crossovers, and then talking about a couple of really in-depth examples of bringing mechanics from other games into it. So bear with us, but returning fan favorite, hopefully fan favorite, Monster Hunter World is a 2018 boss hunt action RPG developed by Capcom, third Capcom game in this list today. Directed by Yuya Tokuda, produced by Hironobu Takeshita, Shingo Izumi, Kazunori Inoue, and designed by Teruki Endo and Yugo Togao.
And luckily, this will probably be one of the last times World comes up, because next time we talk about Monster Hunter, it'll probably be Monster Hunter Rise.
Yeah.
So that'll be new and exciting next time it comes up.
Very quickly, If you're not familiar with the game, Monster Hunter World is a game wherein you set out on missions from a hub world to hunt monsters. And these are fixed duration quests where you have 50 minutes to kill/capture your target. Your actions in the field against the monster are attacking, dodging, and in the case of Monster Hunter World, specifically interacting with your environment. A lot of the times, monsters have telegraphed attacks or maybe even quick, small, just nudges to throw you off your feet. And a lot of your attacks tend to be quite calculated. So it's a lot of pattern recognition, learning when to commit to a longer attack for more damage, and when you can just kind of poke away at a monster. That covers the basics of that, right?
There's a large focus on using the monsters to progress your character, statistically.
Oh!
As well, that's a really big component, wearing the flesh of the things you murder.
Skin them, mash them, stick them in armor, and you get stronger. So you design armor and weapons based on the monsters you kill, and the fashion in the game is truly something really enjoyable.
And a lot of the rewards for the things that we talk about today are all fashion-based, I think. Or at least it's a strong component of them.
A lot of the rewards are, yes, I think there's one mechanical thing. Two mechanical things that I can see in the list. I suppose with that said, jump into just listing a few things then, yeah?
Can we talk about the nature of collaborations first, just as a general philosophical thing, before we talk about this game's collaborations?
Lead us off.
So collaborations are, in this era of service games, an increasingly frequent thing, which can range from just a simple costume being into a game, or from like actual content and characters being in. So if you've played a lot of mobile games, you're probably very familiar with like anime tie-ins or cross-game tie-ins within companies.
Fortnite.
Fortnite as well is a really famous example, where we had Street Fighter in a few weeks ago. Lara Croft is in the week of recording, I think. Awesome. Someone's in.
Aloy.
Aloy.
Almost all of Marvel. Aloy, yeah, sorry.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. Crossovers can be very simple in terms of just, oh, we're bringing in a character or two into our service game, or they can be really elaborate. They can be entire system changes or new mechanics or new items in the game. And Monster Hunter World is, I think, the first Monster Hunter to really deeply engage with this, because while Monster Hunter has a strong history, the other games have service elements to them, like 4 on the 3DS and so on. But World is where we really start going hard on, this is a games as service type product. We have actual collaborations that are limited time. We have seasonal events and so on and so forth.
So at the base level, we have purely cosmetics things, right? World has a couple of these as well. And a couple of quick examples are Capcom internal. So you can get a skin to make you look like Ryu. You can get skins to make you look like Dante from Street Fighter and Devil May Cry, respectively. And they don't do much besides just make you look different. But if we go one step above that to add a small mechanical difference in, we can look at the Assassin's Creed collaboration, where one of the items in the game that helps you during hunts are mantles. They are basically just like hoods that you pull around yourself very quickly, and you get a certain buffer duration. For example, I'll take less damage for a duration. And the Assassin's Creed introduces a mantle that looks like the Assassin's Creed mantle? Hood?
Yes, the classic Altair Ezio sort of thing.
Yeah, I think it's specifically referencing Ezio. It's not just a cosmetic hood. It's not just any of your other mantles that looks different now. It actually is its own mantle, which I forget the name of it. But its mechanic in game is that if you are hidden from a monster, as in it does not yet perceive you, and you land a jumping attack on it, so probably from jumping off a higher elevation, very Assassin's Creed jumping on a target. In the base game, you knock the monster down and you're then able to initiate the fight with a strong advantage. The monster's prone on the ground and you just get to unload your best moves on it. This is unlike anything else in the game. You don't tend to be able to bring an item in that just knocks the monster down. There are a couple of things that can do that, but...
But they're generally large, sort of like some very specific bombs and things, right? That you can't just easily use in combat, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, and it's... monster behavior specific. For example, a flash bomb will knock a flying monster prone, but the monster has to be flying at that time. And a lot of this has changed in the expansion Iceborne. So if you go to Iceborne and you look for this, this doesn't do this anymore. Iceborne reduced the amount of times monsters can be knocked prone, but it still remains that this was a very, very cool collaboration at the time. Moving right along, no fanfare, we go into the Witcher collaboration, which is, I think, another step up. The Witcher collaboration added a lot more with like cutscenes, Geralt of Rivia himself appearing in the game, being able to play a full hunt as Geralt of Rivia, and hunting a brand new monster in Monster Hunter, the Leshen from the Witcher series.
I want to talk a little bit about this quest. So this quest is, it's not exactly a Witcher quest, but it has, incorporates a lot of Witcher elements. Like you go around a map that doesn't have a lot of combat in it for a long time. You talk to people, you get information about the monster. Like Geralt is a very sensible collaboration because he is a monster hunter from his world.
Yep.
But he tackles it with a lot of research, a lot of prep, a lot of knowing what the thing is to know how to best tackle with it, which is ultimately what good players do in Monster Hunter.
To see it narratively laid out.
There's
a whole narrative to the start of this mission.
And I think it's really intriguing to watch that. It looks very out of place for Monster Hunter to the degree that I imagine experienced players might have found it frustrating, but it did lend a lot of authenticity to this crossover, even like little UI changes to make the game look more like the thing. Like every time you do an important conversation or find out new information, big text, you know, main quest updated, blah, 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 subquest updated, blah, 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 blah. I think that's just all really impressive little details that just enhance the, this is the Witcher brought into this world kind of thing.
So one of the things that you get as a tool to fight the Leshen specifically is a new infinite use item that's on a cooldown called Agni, which is a sign. So effectively, you get the ability to cast Witcher magic in the Monster Hunter system. And this is specifically very important mechanically to the Leshen fight because you are able to stop certain moves that the Leshen does by burning away its branches. But the cool thing is that even outside of this mission, once you complete it, Geralt leaves the ability to do the Agni sign. He leaves you a stone that effectively that allows you to cast Agni on command on the same cooldown as your normal hunter. It doesn't do much. It has no mechanical purpose for other fights. No other monster reacts to it the same way, but you can deal a small token of fire damage on an item if you wanted to. It's really cool. Is that all we'd like to say about this? And shall we move on? Because there's a couple more to go. All right, let's go on. So next in the list, which I think does a lot and adds a lot of subsystems. So we saw like a few subsystems added for the Witcher stuff. I think the Resident Evil crossover, again, internal Capcom stuff, which was, this was put into the game around the Resident Evil 2 remake time, definitely like to promote that. I think this crossover does a lot. So it doesn't really give you a brand new monster, but we get a variant on one of the Elder Dragons, one of the big tough monsters in the game. And it introduces a brand new status effect, which is why I think this is really, really big. So in Monster Hunter Base, you can get like poison, you can get various things like paralysis, right? This introduces a new status effect called Zombify, or, you know, becoming a zombie, right? And
complete with just goofily like walking with your arms stretched out in front as well.
So the zombie status effect is super interesting to me because it's not necessarily strictly a debuff. It has some beneficial components to it. For example, while zombified, you regenerate health. You cannot be flinched out of your attacks. So if something hits you and you are trying to attack at the same time, you don't go flying. You just take the hit and keep going through with your attack, much like a zombie doesn't feel pain anymore. And this is beneficial. It means that you may not need to heal and you are able to just power through some damaging attacks to land your own hits in. This is potentially dangerous though, because monsters hit for a lot. It doesn't take many of a monster hits to just down you. So even with regenerating health, if you've positioned yourself poorly, you're gonna just die. And to support that really bad thing, you move really slowly while in the zombified state. The zombie shuffle. To complement this entire zombified status effect, the map hasn't been changed, but brand new items have been sprinkled throughout the map called green herbs, which you would need to undo the zombie state.
And green herbs are a staple of Resident Evil as one of the curative items.
There are even rarer red herbs, which do nothing on their own, but you can, on the field, craft together into green herbs to be a pill that's a lot faster to consume. So the green herbs become like potion drinks, which are slow to consume. And Monster Hunter has two kinds of like consumption speed, drink and eat. And if you combine the green herbs without turning them into potions. with the red herbs, get a pill faster to undo the zombie state. Really fantastic crossover and super, super fun, because unlike the Leshen, where you are mostly doing the same thing, but you have this new Agni, the fight's basically the same. You can't resist zombie. There's various things you can do in the game to resist status effects, like, oh, I don't like being paralyzed. I can make it so I never get paralyzed. Nothing in the game allows you to resist zombie.
I think that the rewards you get from this give you a special Claire skin that has zombie resistance, but that's the reward for doing this 6 or 7 times, by which point you don't need it.
Yeah, that's on the other side of having done it. Yeah, precisely. So
you can't prepare to not deal with this. You have to do it after you've already learned to deal with it.
Which is very much a Monster Hunter staple. Oftentimes, you have to deal with it the hard way before you can be smart about it. And we've gone a bit long, but let's jump into the final example really quick.
It's a lot shorter as well, which helps. It's very much in the thematic side of the crossover. So this is a crossover with Final Fantasy XIV and the Behemoth, one of the iconic Final Fantasy monsters. And this has a lot of just like small aesthetic tweaks. Like when you start the mission, it says duty commence, the Final Fantasy XIV starting text for many missions. You've got a big, dramatic, very Square Enix-style cutscene with lots of crystals and dramatical music.
On the point of cutscenes, there's an entire quest line that leads up to this. It starts with you fighting a monster variant and then, yeah, getting here, basically.
And there are lots of, like, obvious things. Like, it brings in some UI things, like there's an aggro system for this fight where you can see red lines leading to whoever's aggroed, which is a very Final Fantasy XIV UI tweak. There's damage numbers and skill names that pop up when you attack the monster. Because all the attacks in world have names, if you look at the guides, but they won't pop up in battle. And even like the font of the numbers is different for the fight.
Yeah, it's not Monster Hunter font. It's the spaced out numbers that are easier to read for Final Fantasy XIV.
Yeah, and there are lots of even like more subtle things, like this monster casts Meteor periodically, and when it does so, it says in the left of the screen, right of the screen, that it's doing that, and the ground where it's going to land heats up. 14 has like big obvious like bright yellow telegraphs for a lot of attacks, which this doesn't go that far, but it's still bringing in that clear telegraphing from 14.
Lovingly called in the community as MMODDR, where it's just don't stand in the yellow circles.
And then to me, one of the things that stood out when looking at this fight was at sort of the midpoints off when monsters would escape to go to a different area. Here, you have a very big, massive attack that you have a very specific response. You have to hide behind an object to not be hit by the blast. And that feels very MMO-y and not super Monster has like Enraged, where a monster will do new actions, but having like a very set, you hit this HP point and now you have to deal with this one burst.
Also, hiding is not a Monster Hunter verb. There is repositioning. There is being in the right spot to take advantage of the monster doing something. But in this case, yeah, the best thing you can do is hide. And there are things you can do while hiding. Like, it's a really good spot to sharpen your weapons because your weapons get dull as you're fighting. But it's very cool. It changes up the hunt formula. It's not the Resident Evil fight. It's so different. And it's one of the reasons that I really pushed for Monster Hunter World to be on this list is because, yeah, a lot of these collaborations are relatively typical sounding, but the lengths that the company went, that the studio and the developers went to bring in aspects that are so not Monster Hunter is really cool, really worth applauding.
I think it's a great example of what we're talking about, which is crossovers that bring in the mechanics of things. Because not just we brought in this monster, hey, isn't it cool? It's we brought in the Behemoth and we thought about how MMO raids are different to Monster Hunter fights and what we can bring in to just add a bit more of that raid feeling to this boss. It's still a Monster Hunter monster, fundamentally, but it has that like little bits of flavor that change up how you deal with it just a bit. And it's not the strongest thing. Like the Resident Evil one is the strongest example of like an in-depth collab here, I think.
I feel, yeah, in my experience at least.
But because I understand 14, this is the one I understand most.
Yeah.
But with that, now that you hopefully understand these things pretty well, let's go into our ending summaries. And with that, we've come to the end of the episode. So let's go through what we've learned about crossovers in a mechanical sense today. So we started with Professor Layton versus Phoenix Wright, and we saw how different franchises, when they come together, can fill in the blanks and inform the other franchise to give it a very different feel and change sort of many of the more subtle aspects. And in this case, the writing and tone of Layton really goes on to influence the kinds of mysteries that Phoenix has to solve. Then we went into Cadence of Hyrule, which, much like Layton and Wright, sort of took two different franchises and had them sort of govern different aspects of the game. But Cadence sort of brings in a bunch of Zelda into the format of Crypt of the Necrodancer to change the feeling, change how many verbs you have, that gives it a very different feeling, again, to classic Crypt of the Necrodancer, while still feeling very Zelda in sort of the permanence that the game will generally have. And then we looked at Etrian Mystery Dungeon, which combines two games that on one hand feel very similar in terms of what they are, but are also deeply philosophically quite different ideas of dungeon crawlers, and merge to create something that, while embodying the best of both these franchises, also feels like neither of the franchises, to create something unique and distinctive.
Did you like the simple ideas of like game A meets game B? Well, that goes out the window now, because the fourth game we talked about was such an ambitious idea. Why don't we take any possible Capcom fighting game character and any possible SNK fighting game character and give them a game they could live in? Obviously, this is not every character from either of those two franchises, but Capcom versus SNK 2, Mark of the Millennium 2001, is this marriage of game philosophy between two very different game companies, specifically in the fighting game. And lastly, we talked about Monster Hunter World, where honestly, that was a mini list on its own to show you kind of the spectrum of how you can go from simple cosmetic collaborations all the way up to deep mechanical integrations for your collaborations. However, all still being rooted in the Monster Hunter-based game. They do their best to give you different feel, but yeah, you get slightly different flavored Monster Hunters by playing the Resident Evil flavor or the Final Fantasy flavor.
And with that, everyone, thank you for listening. If you want to talk to us about anything we discussed, any interesting collaborations or crossovers that you know of that maybe we missed, so many really interesting crossovers and collaborations in video games that it's hard to know what we could have talked about, you should tweet at the show, at Platin Pit. We always love talking about these games. You can also find our personal Twitter accounts in the show notes. And if you aren't one for Twitter, we have a Facebook page and an email in the show notes. We're also part of the Pixels for Breakfast Network. And as such, you can find us on the Pixels for Breakfast Discord and chat with us about the show in a more sort of real-time format compared to just Twitter and emails. And as a part of that, I have been writing articles for Pixels for Breakfast. So you can find some of my writing on that website. I've looked at Chaos Rings recently, and by the time this comes out, maybe something else.
Mysterious, but you have my attention.
Yes. Blue, if you want more of you, where can they find that?
If you're interested in my rambling in a lot less of a structured format, weekly, attemptedly weekly, I produce a podcast with the Pixels for Breakfast himself, Steve Heller, where we cover a lot of the gaming news and then talk a bit about our thoughts on whatever we're playing right now. So yeah, please give that a listen if that sounds up your alley.
And it's really interesting because both of you guys are from a developer side, and so you give a lot of different insight than the standard sort of news, what we've been playing kind of podcast. So I think it's a really interesting thing.
We try, but I can give you a summary right now. Give more money to games and love your developers more. That's a lot of our message.
I mean, I think that's a great message, and we should probably more explicitly state that on this show, really.
Maybe.
Some games that you might want to give some money to get yourself ready for the next episode are Diablo 2, Fallout New Vegas, Fighting EX Layer, Wild Arms Crossfire, and Deep Rock Galactic. And we'll be also recording an addendum episode to release in July for our third anniversary that's coming up. So if you have any thoughts from episodes that we've done in the last several years, feel free to send us a question and we'll answer it there. We've also got stockpiled a few questions we've gotten throughout various sources over the last 6 months or so.
Did you mean to leave the topic for next month vague?
No.
Oh, because you didn't say it. So we've just given them a list of games.
Well, the topic is customization. So what we're going to talk about how customization in these games functions and how that relates to the content in the game, how the content works in relationship to that customization system.
This is going to be interesting because this is a very varied list of genres.
That's ideally what we do. It's the point of the show. It's not all supposed to be roguelikes with turn-based elements like today.
I hope you're ready. I hope I'm ready for that one.
Someone will be ready for that one, maybe. I'm really excited to be covering it. Such a diverse collection of games, most of which from developers that we haven't talked about before, which is really exciting.
That's going to be good, yeah.
It's the opposite of this episode in many ways. And with that,
thank you for listening.